Jews knew how to survive, and now we've returned. Do you know how Jews still survive? They survive in the text. The art of composing is one that comes through some kind of nearly divine channel, divine inspiration, but it's depicted as the immediate, intense reaction to pain and loss and anxiety and suffering. That, at least, is the art of writing for Agnon. Everything about him, from his name to his date of birth to the date of his aliyah, his arrival in the land of Israel, everything was mythologized. Everything was part of the fable the author crafts about his own identity. Creativity, in all its forms, is the most authentic Jewish response to pain, to catastrophe, to exile, to destruction. Good evening and welcome back to our fourth session. Tonight, exploring Agnon's great novel, A Guest for the Night, in Hebrew, as Oreach Nata Lalun, the work that was singled out by the Nobel Committee as Agnon's greatest achievement as a novelist. It's certainly his book which most closely reaches the perfection of the form of the novel as it was understood and defined in the 1930s, a literary form, which I will observe we had suggested Dan Miron's essay on Agnon and the novel, a genre which Agnon had trouble domesticating, a foreign genre Agnon had trouble domesticating. It is certainly Agnon's novel with the most distinctly autobiographical feel and actual content to it, although I hasten to observe that we should always be careful never to fall into the trap, a trap deliberately set by Agnon, of confusing Agnon the man and the character he creates, even when the character, the narrating first-person narrator in the novel, shares so many biographical details with his creator. The actual biographical story behind the novel goes like this. In 1930, Shokin was publishing the first edition of Agnon's collected writings in four volumes. It was being published in Leipzig, Germany. In 1930, the center of Hebrew publishing was still not just Europe, but Germany, believe it or not. The publishing industry in the land of Israel was not sufficiently professional or aesthetic or on the level of Mr. Shokin's high demands, and the work was done in Germany. Leipzig to this day is still the center of publishing in Europe. If you ever have an opportunity to visit Leipzig, I cannot recommend enough the wonderful, fascinating Museum of the History of Printing, which has an actual working model of Gutenberg's printing press and all the other technologies up until our own day. It's for those of us that are lovers of literature and lovers of the physical object, the book, it's a fascinating must-see. But when Agnon goes back to supervise the publication of his work, he makes a kind of nostalgic homecoming visit in Galicia, his native region, and Buchach, his hometown, on his return to Jerusalem. It was in fact his only real substantive visit back home since leaving as a youngster in 1908. Aside from two very, very, very brief visits in 1913, right before and right after his father's death, he never returned. It really is, though, as I've mentioned in some of our earlier sessions, a perfect example of you can take the boy out of Buchach, but you can't take the Buchach out of the boy. Even though he leaves in 1908 with only one visit of a number of days he Buchach lives within him, and it's occupying him. Some people occupy territory. In other cases, territory occupies the person. And the need to exorcise the Buchach within remains a lifelong obsession for 60 years after he leaves. It's the only return he makes to the Altaheim, to the old world, the old home he had left behind. And this really does underscore the presence of Buchach in all of his writings. When he arrives, he's received with great fanfare. He was already something of a minor celebrity. He was turning 43 or 42, depending upon which birthday you believe, but in reality, 43 that summer of his visit. And the town, the Jews and the non-Jews alike, received him with great acclaim as the local boy who had gone off to the land of Israel and had become an accomplished, now middle-aged author. Young Chachkis had left Buchach, and he returns to us as the middle-aged Agnon, a renowned author. He spent only 7 days in Buchach itself. And the most significant outcome of that visit is our novel, A Guest for the Night. In A Guest for the Night, we have the portrait of a kind of nostalgic homecoming visit to not Buchach, but the literary doppelganger that he creates, Shibush. In other words, he takes the sound, the letters of Buchach, mixes them up to create a pen name, as it were, for his town, and he calls it Shibush. You can understand how Buchach and Shibush sound like an anagram of each other. But Shibush, of course, is a Hebrew term meaning mixed up, muddled, broken down. In Yiddish, a Shibishul is a little nothing. It might mean a postage stamp, but it becomes a kind of idiom for something minor and insignificant. This little hometown of mine. There are, of course, many very significant differences between the autobiography and the actual fiction. And the main one is that Agnon takes this 7-day visit and expands it to a visit that runs almost a year, over 10 months long. Our guest, the narrating guest, the title character of the novel, the guest that comes back to Buchach, he arrives on the eve of Yom Kippur, a rather significant, heavy, weighty date in the Jewish calendar, the eve of the Day of Atonement, and spends the whole cycle of the year until late in the summer after Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av, the day of national calamity and catastrophe about which we spoke in our first session. So this kind of movement from the grandeur of Yom Kippur to the tragedy, the trauma of Tisha B'Av, kind of marks or echoes a downward spiral as he spends this long visit back home. One who reads A Guest for the Night encounters a portrait of Buchach, or Shibush, as it's called in the novel, in decline. World War I has decimated the town, and by the way, so much of Europe. Today, we forget the traumas of World War I because it, of course, all becomes overshadowed by the even greater traumas of World War II, and not only the Holocaust, but certainly that. It's a portrait of how the town, which he had so idealized in his stories and in his memory, is depicted as in decline, spiritually, physically, economically, mentally, socially, all regards. It's a shadow of itself. It's broken. It really is mishubash. It really is quite broken down. And an unknowledgeable reader who encounters the work could very easily make the following mistaken assumption. this is clearly a novel written probably in the 1950s with full knowledge of what happened to Buchach, but set in 1930. The author, aware of the destruction of European Jewry, aware of the destruction of European Jewish civilization, aware of the physical destruction of the towns and shtetlach and villages that housed the Jewish people, now with hindsight of the 1950s, looks back, sets a story in the 1930s as if to say the handwriting was on the wall, folks. And you would be forgiven for thinking that, except for the fact that it's historically false. The story was written sometime in the late 1930s, and it was serialized in the Haaretz newspaper. You may have noticed the chapters are all, there are 80 chapters, they're all rather brief. That was a convention of writing a serialized novel. The novel was serialized in the newspaper over the course of about 6 months, from the fall of 1938 to the spring of 1939. And then it was published in book form in September 1939. You may be aware there were other things going on in the world at the beginning of September 1939. Here's Buchach. This is a colorized photo. The large building is the Great Synagogue. The smaller building is the Beit Midrash, the study hall, which also was a kind of library. The study hall will become significant as we move through our story. Here's a 1901 panoramic postcard. The marketplace. The Stripa River, which through the eyes of the narrator, particularly in Agnon's stories of childhood, where the adult narrator regresses to his childlike self to recall what it was like to grow up in a town with a river. Now you see, it's hardly a stream, but in the mind of the child, it's the mighty Mississippi. This river to Agnon, the childhood narrator in Agnon's tales, is the Mississippi to Huck and Tom. A recent photo of Buchach in the snow. This is the Rathaus, the Buchach town hall, which was built in the middle of the 18th century by Count Potocki. The region was owned by these Polish noblemen. Governor Potocki, late of New York, is somehow a descendant of this Polish noble family who owned Buchach. It was built by the famous European architect Bernard Meriton. And this rather impressive Rococo-style building in the center of a small town, it really was one of the most distinct architectural landmarks in the whole region and still stands until today, is really something to behold. It's almost completely out of place. One wonders how it landed there in the middle of Buchach, and it features prominently in many of Agnon's stories of Buchach. The Jewish cemetery, which plays such a central role in our story, as do all of these other places. That's the reason I've chosen these photographs. The cemetery in Buchach, in our tale of woe, our tale of decline, is very much a center of gravity. People are dying all the time. The town is falling apart, and the only upkeep of the town is the road that leads from town out to the cemetery, because that's the road that's traveled the most. The description of the town as the grave diggers working overtime and the midwives being out of work says a lot about what direction the town was heading. And finally, today, outside of the childhood home of Agnon on what today is Agnon Street, named after him in Buchach, right opposite the river, there's a bust of Agnon. The Ukrainians are very proud of the Ukrainian author who won the Nobel Prize. In the city hall, there's an exhibit to him, which may have been corrected in the last couple of years, but at one point neglected to mention that he was awarded the Nobel Prize for writing literature in Hebrew. Agnon, of course, would not have been able to write even probably a shopping list in Ukrainian. But nevertheless, they're proud of local boy done well. The pending doom is telegraphed on every page. The story is published in September 1939, but it had been completed already well more than a year earlier. This is the Haaretz newspaper for September 8th, 1939, exactly a week after Hitler invades Poland. You see how naive, how bad newspapers are at getting it right. The headline in the newspaper a week after the Polish invasion is "Hatotachim." The invasion of Poland is "Hatotachim atzarfatim tokfim et bitzarei Germanim." The French cannons are fighting back against the German forces. But in other words, there's still hope that those French, they're going to take care of this whole mess, and it'll be over soon. How naive! How tragically naive! But in the next slide, we see an advertisement that appeared in the newspaper that day announcing the publication of Oreach Natal Alun in book form. The novel that you had read in serialized last year is now available as a special volume, dear readers of Haaretz. Haaretz, of course, is owned by the Shokin family. Agnon is the house author of the newspaper, and he's published by the family's printing house. However, it's a perfect example that sometimes the writers of ad copies don't know what they're doing, because the advertisement says, in his unique style and artistic manner, Agnon portrays for us the vanishing past and the shining future of the world left behind. But there is no shining future. It's all downhill from here. The title of the book, A Guest for the Night, is drawn from a verse in the book of Jeremiah. Mikveh Yisrael Moshi'o Be'et Sara. The prophet turns to God and says, O hope of Israel, savior of Israel at times of trouble, Lama tieh keger ba'aretz uke'oreach natal alun. Why should you, Lord, be like a stranger in the land and like a guest for the night? In other words, God, if you fulfill your promise to destroy the temple and banish the Jewish people, you yourself are going to have to go into exile with us. And then you, God, will be diminished because you won't be present with us in our home in the land of Israel. And you will only be like a passing guest, a guest for the night. Why should you be like a man overcome, like a mighty man unable to save? What will the non-Jews say? What will the other nations say when they see Israel defeated and dispersed and banished? It'll look bad for you, God. This is an old trope in the arsenal of prophets in their arguing with God, right? God, you should do it for God's sake. You should save us. You should spare us. Because how will it look for you? Your name, God, will be desecrated. And then you will be guilty of desecrating your own name. So in the biblical source, the guest for the night is none other than God himself. Here it's repurposed for the narrator who returns home and sees how bad things are. He's now returned as a middle-aged man, having been away since late childhood, since late adolescence, and he wants to help. He wants to save. But what's the problem? He's only a guest. That idea of alienation, the paradox of being a guest in your own home, is extremely disorienting. A number of years ago, I had the opportunity to go back and visit my own hometown in New Jersey. Shortly after I came to live in Israel, almost 30 years ago, my parents moved away. So I really didn't have much opportunity ever to go back. But a couple of years ago, I was driving through New Jersey with one of my sons, who was younger then than he is today. And I said, hey, let's go see, let me show you the house I grew up in. Let's go look at the elementary school I went to. We went inside. I couldn't understand what happened. They had shrunk everything down. The water fountains that used to be right about here when I was in first grade were now very, very low to the ground. And those desks, why do they make the desks so small? How can anybody fit into them? That idea of being completely at home, I hadn't stepped foot in that elementary school for as many years as Ogden had not stepped foot in Buchach. I could have drawn you a floor plan down to the inch of what Washington Avenue Elementary School looked like. But to go back was to be disoriented. It was to kind of step into like one of those Escher paintings, you know, where the laws of reality don't match up with the facts on the ground. This is a topic that we're going to discuss next week when we encounter Ogden's modernistic or perhaps surrealistic writings. The oxymoron of being an alien at home is so central to the horror of modernity that we cannot even be home, even in our own home. That is the great theme, well, of much of Ogden's writings, but particularly here. The guest arrives on the eve of Yom Kippur, and we see in the opening chapter, Bati Le'iri, I came to my hometown. On the eve of the Day of Atonement in the afternoon, I changed from the express to the local train that runs to my hometown. The Jews who had traveled with me got out and went their way, while Gentile townsfolk, men and women, made their way in. The wheels rolled sluggishly between hills and mountains, valleys and gorges. At every station, the train stopped and lingered, let out people and baggage, and started up again. After 2 hours, signs of shibush sprouted from both sides of the road. I put my hand to my heart. My hand throbbed against my heart, just as my heart throbbed under my hand. The townsfolk put out their pipes and shoved them into their leggings, got up to collect their baggage, and sat down again. The women elbowed their way to the window, crying, Rabarovich, Rabarovich, and laughed. The train whistled and puffed, whistled again, then sprawled to rest opposite the station. Here's the train station of Buchach, as it looked then, as it still looks today. The text continues. Along came the dispatcher, called Rabarovich. His left arm had been lost in the war. The new one they gave him was made of rubber. In the Hebrew text, his name is Gumovitz. Gumi in Hebrew is rubber. The translator has anglicized it so that the play on words still works. He's the first character we meet who is disabled, defected. He's missing an arm which he lost in the war. And the town is full of characters who are maimed, who are missing legs. One character, the town beggar, Ignatz, is missing a nose, and there's just this open cavity. And it's described in such a grotesque manner. You can hear his breathing, whistling in and out of this open cavity. And his speech is kind of represented in a funny way, because somebody who's missing their nose, someone who's missing their nose, well, their speech will be affected. Everyone is damaged, but the physical blemishes are of course just on the surface. They're anecdotes for They're analogs for the fact that everyone is also somehow spiritually damaged, or at least almost everyone. Well, Rabarovich stood erect, waving the flag in his hand, and called, Shibush! It was many years since that I had heard the name of Shibush coming from the lips of a man of my town. Only he who is born there, and bred there, and lives there, knows how to pronounce every single letter of that name. After Rabarovich had got the name of Shibush out of his mouth, he licked his mustache as if he had been munching sweetmeats. This idea of the ability to pronounce the name of the hometown, the special skill to pronounce every single letter of the name, is of course an idea that the author is borrowing from nothing less than entering the Holy of Holies in the Jerusalem Temple. God's ineffable name, Yud Hey Vov Hey, which is pronounced only in the Holy Temple, in our reading of the Bible and the Torah in synagogue, in our reciting of verses, in our pronouncing of brachot, of blessings in Hebrew, we don't ever pronounce the word as it's spelled. We substitute it with the name Adonai. But that's not how it's spelled. The name Yud Hey Vav Hey, which sometimes people point to that proselytizing religion, the Jehovah's Witnesses, that their name of their religion is an anglicization of that holy name, which is never pronounced except by the high priest in the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement, because he knows the proper way to pronounce the name, every single letter of the name. So Hagnon is turning this character, this Roborovich, this comical character licking his mustache coated with sweetmeats. Who is he? Well, we're entering, the train is coming into the station. We're entering into the Holy of Holies. We're coming back to our hometown on the eve of Yom Kippur. Well, he arrives. He has to find a place to stay. He has to make provisions for himself. He has to get a proper meal, because it is, after all, the eve of the Day of Atonement. And in just a few hours, he has to get to synagogue to pray. The walk from the train station into the center of town, which used to be just a matter of a few minutes, takes forever, because he stops at each and every stop along the way to examine how it's all different, how the buildings have changed, and even the space between the buildings have changed. The story presents the dialectical poles of nostalgia and nightmare. Those are ideas that were popularized by the important American literary critic Arnold Band, nostalgia and nightmare. As he's trying to find his way into town, he encounters a group of young men. They identify themselves all as free thinkers. They appear to be Jews who have left the tradition. And one among them, a character named Daniel Bach, is standing there with a peg leg. He's the second character we meet maimed. But his damage, the damage done to him, is not just to his leg, but to his soul. Because having lost his leg in the war, he has also lost his faith. He directs the guest to where he can find a place for the night. He walks along. The narrator says, every place was changed. Nothing was as it had been when I was little, nor as it had been shown to me in a dream shortly before my return. But the odor of shibush, the smell of shibush, had not yet evaporated. The smell of millet boiled in honey, which never leaves the town from the day after Passover until the end of November, when the snow falls, covering all. There's a smell, there's a local meichel, there's a local dish, millet boiled in honey, which is somehow evocative of his youth, of his childhood. Everything's changed, everything's broken except for the smell coming out of the houses. This, of course, reminds us of Marcel Proust's Madeleines. You know, Proust, who was indeed Jewish, writes what's considered the longest novel. I mean, it's published in multiple books because you can't fit that many pages between two covers. But depending upon which translation you're using, Remembrance of Things Past or The Search for Lost Time, either of which would have been excellent titles for our work. Proust certainly was an author that Agnon was mindful of. In Proust's novel, even if you've never read Proust, and let's be honest, none of us have read all of Proust, but everybody knows the Madeleines, these little scalloped-shaped cookies dipped in tea, and the smell and the taste of them create this flood of memories, the evocative nature of smell and taste in order to bring us back to to childhood. Each of us has an example of this. If we were all gathered together in the physical world, we'd go around and everyone would tell the story. I remember my great-grandmother feeding me spoonfuls of butter because, having come from Russia, she knew it wasn't good for a little Jewish boy to be too skinny. The nostalgia depicted by Proust, by Agnon, reminds us that nostalgia is a word we have to be careful about using. Nostalgia does not mean what we think it means when we use it to mean, that happy feeling of, getting together with friends that we went to school together with decades ago, or old campmates, or people that we served together with in the army. Nostalgia, it's a Homeric word. It may have been coined by Homer. Nostos is homecoming. Algos, like an analgesic, is against pain. Algos is pain or ache. It's the heartache of going home, of knowing that you can't go home again. And that, of course, is the other significant work that somehow I associate with A Guest for the Night. At exactly the same time that Agnon was writing A Guest for the Night, the great Southern author, the great American author of the American South, Thomas Wolfe, is writing You Can't Go Home Again, which has very, very many parallels between the two stories. It's about an author who leaves his small southern town, goes off to the big city, makes it big, returns home for a visit, only to discover that the townsmen were none too thrilled that they were serving as fodder, thinly veiled fodder, for his work. But look at this line from the 1940 You Can't Go Home Again. You can't go back home to your family, back home to your childhood, back home to a young man's dreams of glory and of fame, back home to places in the country, back home to the old forms and systems of things which once seemed everlasting, but which are changing all the time. Back home to the escapes of time and memory. Again, I'm certain that Agnon did not know Wolfe, and I'm certain that Wolfe did not know Agnon, but, they didn't know each other's writings. But this line, translated to Hebrew, could just as easily have appeared in our story. On Yom Kippur, he shows up to the services and is shocked to discover that on the one night of the year where the synagogue is usually packed, in many synagogues in America, they used to open up the back wall into the social hall. I remember the synagogue I grew up in. They'd open up the back wall to house all the people that would come just one night a year. But it's practically empty. The town has been spiritually desiccated. But at the end of the day on Yom Kippur, for the prayer of Ni'ilah, the closing prayer, a few more people do come in for one reason or another, perhaps out of guilt, perhaps out of a sense of, of nostalgia, that kind of painful homecoming, to get yourself back to the synagogue. And we encounter the figure of Rabbi Shlomo Bach, the great cantor of Buchach, who really is one of Agnon's most noble characters. This is late in the afternoon on Yom Kippur. The sun stood in the treetops close to the setting. The walls of the Beit Midrash darkened and a few candles dimly lit its duskiness. People who had not been in synagogue all day came in and stood there, sadly, their eyes twitching as they looked at the cantor who lifted up his voice and chanted the first psalm of Ni'ilah, the closing service. The whole day long they had sat at home as if ashamed, but now that the sun was setting and the hour had arrived when the judgment is sealed, they rose and went to the Beit Midrash, to the study hall. After I had finished the silent prayer, I saw Daniel Bach, that apikoris, that free thinker, that heretic who I had encountered when I got off the train. He was there, standing, bowed in front of the table at the southern end, beside the door, with a book in his hand. He was standing in the same position as the cantor, but the cantor stood on both his feet, while one of Daniel Bach's legs was made of wood. The worshippers drew nearer to the cantor. He clapped both his hands in joy and read, Yisrael Noshab Hashem, Israel is delivered by the Lord with an eternal deliverance. Clapping once again, he says, even today they will be delivered by the word of thy mouth, O dweller on high. These are the words of the Piyutim at the end of the Ni'ilah. A sound of weeping rose from the darkness, like the voices of a crowd supporting the cantor in his prayer. The doors of the ark stood open, like a heavenly ear attentive to Israel's prayer. From the table in the south beside the door, there was a dull sound, like wood striking on wood. Daniel Bach had changed his position. Again, the same sound was heard, as of wood striking on wood. It seemed that his foot could find no rest. When the cantor came to the verse, "Every city is builded in its place, and the city of God is degraded to the depths of hell." Kol ir al tila bnuya ve'ir ha'elokim mushpalat ad shol tachter. He wept for a long time. Why is he weeping over this line? Well, what is the city of God that has been brought down low, that has been desecrated, that has been degraded to the depths of hell? Well, certainly in the context of the prayer, we're talking of Jerusalem, of Jerusalem destroyed, of Jerusalem vanquished, the city of God. But why is he crying? Because there's another city of God. There are many cities of God. Buchach is a town which is a city of God. And it too has been degraded. And for as long as he wept at this line, so long did he raise his voice in joy at the line, Ki anu amecha, we are thy people. After the shofar had been blown to mark the end of the fast, all those who had come to the closing service went away, except for Daniel Bach, who remained in the Beit Midrash. The wayward Daniel Bach is the son of the noble cantor. The Bach family becomes a very significant center of gravity in the story. We don't have time to go into the dozens of supporting characters. I am just presenting the frame story, but in the 80 chapters, we encounter scores of characters. In the New English edition, I felt compelled to create a kind of dramatis personae, a cast of characters with one-line biographies of who each character is, because otherwise it becomes a little difficult to keep track of the action in the novel. Well, at the end of Yom Kippur, the narrator is aware that, well, this is it. There's not much action going on in the study hall or in the synagogue during the rest of the year. People are no longer going to synagogue. People are fleeing the town. It's emptying out. Last one out, close off the lights. When they're leaving the town, well, they're not going off to the land of Israel by and large. They're headed for the Golden Medina. They're headed to America if they can get there. The narrator says to the kind of trustees of the place, well, what's going to happen? Who's going to be here to maintain and manage the Beit Midrash, the study hall, the center of Jewish spiritual life? And they say, well, if you'd like to, the job is all yours. And they hand him the large, heavy brass key, which probably looked something like this. This is an antique that I picked up at a flea market years ago, and I use it as a prop whenever talking about this story. The next morning, the narrator goes, he opens the Beit Midrash. As the winter comes, he pays to have wood brought to heat the building. And slowly, slowly, people start coming. He puts out some tea, a few cookies. He must have like, you know, heard about how Chabad works. And Jews start coming. And, you know, he thinks he's doing something, but he knows full well the reason that the people are returning to the study hall is because they can't afford to heat their own homes. And if you come for an afternoon in the Beit Midrash, well, it's warm there. And, you know, you can get a cup of tea and a cookie. And, you know, they're Jews after all. If somebody needs you to be the 10th man to make the minyan, you're happy to help. But the narrator knows that it's, at best, nothing more than a spiritual halfway house. A few chapters after initiating this big project in town, he loses the key. One morning he shows up, he searches his pockets, he can't find it. He looks through the keyhole. He can see into the Beit Midrash. but he can't get there. And he considers, you know, that's a whole world. There's an entire civilization in those books, in that place, in those prayers, and it's just on the other side of the door. But I can't get in. The missing key becomes the central symbol throughout the novel. With the key, the people of Shibush can still hope to gain access to the world behind the door. An earlier world where tradition still mattered, but with the door closed and locked, like the magic cave in the fable of the goat being slaughtered, we no longer have access. The father of the story can't get there. One needs some kind of magical transport. Well, while he's standing there looking through the keyhole, along clops Daniel Bach and gives him a good piece of advice. He says, well, why don't you do what I did? I used to have a leg, but I lost it, so I had a replacement made. Call the locksmith, he'll come, and he'll make you a new key, which is exactly what the narrator does. But you understand the irony here, of course. With the replacement key, he reopens the Beit Midrash, but the degree to which his whole effort to revive and to reawaken, to create a Jewish renaissance in a spiritually decrepit town, he understands it's just a fake. It's just a shadow. It's an ersatz Beit Midrash. If, God forbid, you lose your leg, a peg leg is quite efficient at helping you get around. Of course, today we have much better prosthetics, but you understand which kind of leg Daniel Bach had. Think Captain Ahab. The peg leg can help you hobble around, but it's not the same as flesh and blood. The replacement key reminds him, you can't go home again. You can't go back to the house of study when the values and the traditions of the house of study are no longer in force and valued. Well, we're going to cut the story quite a bit short. After nearly a year in town, the narrator knows it's time to go. There have been countless side stories and stories within this frame, and all different types of characters, everyone from Haredim to Hasidim to socialists to communists to kibbutznikim, people preparing themselves to go off to the land of Israel. Everybody has a moment on the stage in this story, but at the end of the story, two characters, Rachel and Yerucham, who really do play a very significant role in the story, but I'm going to leave that aside from now. Rachel and Yerucham, who have been married, have a baby. Quite unusual, because as I told you, the midwives have all been out of work. Nobody's bringing new life into the town. And the narrator takes this as an optimistic sign. With the arrival of this child, he thinks maybe there is hope for continuity. And now he can abandon his post and return to his family in Jerusalem. And serving as the sandik, the godfather, at the brit, at the circumcision for this new baby, he gifts the child the key, I mean the replacement key, in the hope that he will grow to help the city continue. When he gets back home with that optimistic thought in mind, well, you know, we know we're so much smarter than the narrator because we know what happens. We know that 3 weeks after the story began being published in the newspaper, just 3 weeks after the story began being published, was Kristallnacht. The note of optimism at the end, well, it becomes dashed. But in an epilogue to the story, after arriving back in Jerusalem, one day there's an astonishing find. This is the penultimate chapter in the book. His wife, going through his suitcase, discovers the original key, which apparently had slid between the lining of his case. "What are you thinking of doing with that original key?" said my wife. "Send it back to Shibush?" "The one they have is superfluous," said I. "And you tell me to burden them with a second key? They already have a key, but they don't use it. What do they need two keys for a Beit Midrash which isn't being used?" "Well," said my wife, "what will you do with it?" There came into my mouth the saying of our sages of blessed memory, "The synagogues and study halls abroad are destined to be established in the land of Israel." And I said to myself, when they establish themselves in the land of Israel, this man, I, will have the key in his possession. He's making reference to a passage in the Talmud, in Tractate Megillah, which says that the verse in Ezekiel, Ve'eyalehem mikdash ma'at, that in the diaspora, in the dispersion, in the exile, God will be for the Jewish people a sanctuary in the places that they will be sent, a miniature sanctuary, a little sanctuary in the absence of the Jerusalem Holy Temple. Rabbi Yitzchak said, this is referring to the synagogues and study halls in Babylonia, that in the absence of the Holy Temple, our synagogues, our places of worship, our places of study, are the closest place to the encounter with the divine. Rabbi Elazar HaKapar said, in the future, the synagogues and the study halls in Babylonia being a synecdoche for all of exile, will be transported and reestablished in the land of Israel. At the time of the Messiah, not only will the Jews be brought from all four corners of the earth, but the synagogues and study halls themselves will be uprooted and flown on some magic carpet and will be reestablished. Imagine your synagogue in wherever you may be, in suburban New Jersey, being picked up and transported and placed somewhere, I don't know where exactly, there aren't too many empty lots, but somewhere here in Jerusalem. So that's what the narrator is saying. He goes on, I rose and put the key in a box and hung the key of the box over my heart. I did not hang the key of the old Beit Midrash over my heart, for it was too heavy for my heart to bear. The key being put away in its place, I returned to my work. And whenever I remembered it, I would repeat to myself, the synagogues and study halls are destined one day to return. And I would open my window and look outside to see if perhaps they were making their way to establish themselves in the land of Israel. Alas, the land was desolate and silent, and the sound of the steps of the synagogue in Bate Medrashot was not heard. And still the key lies there waiting with me for that day. However, it is made of iron and brass, and it can wait. But I, who am flesh and blood, find it hard to endure. In the final chapter of the work, we see him visiting the nearby Kibbutz Ramat Rachel in southern Jerusalem, which is actually very, very close walk to Agnon's home of Talpiot. He encounters Rabbi Shlomo Bach, the old cantor, who in his golden years had come on Aliyah. A different son, not Daniel, a different son had preceded him to the land of Israel, but unfortunately was tragically killed in the Arab uprising the year before. And he's an old man. He's tending the kibbutz vegetable patch and channeling the worldview of the great Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook, the first chief rabbi of the land of Israel, who was a very significant figure in Agnon's life. Elsewhere, I've written about that connection and about this passage. But Rabbi Shlomo Bach communicates the worldview of Rabbi Cook, who talks about the Torah of the land of Israel, that the Torah itself was designed to be lived and actualized in the land of Israel, something which he had never fully understood all his years living in Buchach. The family name Bach is an acronym. It's clearly a reference to the rabbinical code, the Bayit Chadash, a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. The Bayit Chadash, known colloquially as the Bach through the acronymic Bet Chet, is the family name of this fellow, the only one to come on Aliyah, the only one to actualize his dream, the only one to kind of maintain his nobility and his integrity amidst so much degradation. I have no doubt that in calling this character Bach, Agnon is planting an idea between the lines. Bayit Chadash, the new home. You can't go home again because you can't go back in time. You can't step into the same river twice. Despite the guest's most well-intentioned attempt to revivify and re-engage the lost world, it's doomed. It's a fool's errand. The Alte Heim, the old home, can no longer exist. It's a place where we can only be passing guests. But you can go home again if you understand and reconceptualize the idea of home in a new home. And in this story, which is a horrifying depiction of the fate of European Jewry, it really does end on an optimistic note. Quite unusual for Agnon, where many of the stories end tragically. Remember the goat. But it ends on a kind of optimistic note that Zionism, that the return and the flourishing of the settlement of Jewish life in our new home is the home we can go to again. The fact that he wrote this before he could have known the ultimate disposition of what happened in Buchach, where in June 1943, the thousands of residents of the Buchach ghetto were rounded up and taken out to that cemetery and executed in a mass action, doesn't prevent us from marveling at the fact of how far-sighted he was in this work of literature. He ends on an optimistic note that there can be a new home. But you know, Agnon, he wasn't always so kind. Sometimes he was mean to his readers. He couldn't leave well enough alone. You remember last week in the bridal canopy, we meet the great-great-great-grandson of Reb Yudel Chosid as the protagonist of a different novel. In a late work called Kisui Hadam, The Covering of the Blood, perhaps the most significant work that's not yet translated, that's in desperate need of translation to English. It's one of Agnon's most direct treatments of the Holocaust. It's also the only story of his where there's any action that takes place in the United States. It takes place in a slaughterhouse on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. We encounter an old shochet, an old ritual slaughterer of meat. And he's a Holocaust survivor, and it's a very profound story. It's a kind of modernized Book of Job. But between the lines, we discover that, yes, Rabbi Shlomo Bach had gone off to the land of Israel and lived out his days tending the kibbutz farm. But Daniel Bach, he stayed behind. And we know what happened to him. He, like so many others, was killed in Auschwitz. I think we'll end there, although there's much more to say about this story. In adopting the obviously westernized, obviously Europeanized form of storytelling, Agnon was bucking the expectation of his audience, and they didn't like it initially. They wanted more stories like the fable of the goat, and instead they got stories that reminded them of Kafka. That comparison agitated Agnon to no end.